tabulates to $5,040 in a year. This no good trifling backstabbing Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, is getting $1,000 an hour. This man makes $8,000 in one day, and a family of two, $5,040 in a year. It's outrageous. And then to come after folks that have lost work, that have lost jobs, that are sticking and staying in Detroit to try to help to rebuild and repopulate my city, and then to say what we're going to do is turn your water off because you can't pay for it.
We're gonna
going to tolerate this mess.
We're going to have to leave it.
Tolerate.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we will certainly continue to cover this crucial issue. Maureen Taylor, state chair of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, Mira Karanananthan, is international water campaigner for the Blue Planet Project. That does it for our show. Our website is democracynow.org. We have job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Back in about 10.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned for Tuesday evening KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from stateconstitutions.us, committed to empowering people of every state by providing the complete text and audio of their state constitutions. Those seeking to hold state governments accountable can learn more at stateconstitutions.us.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland judge rules the federal no-fly list unconstitutional.
Local residents pack a town hall meeting on the proposed street fee in the city of Portland.
AT&T announces a potential merger with DirecTV.
This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 24th, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Neil Thompson. 3 months ago, U.S. District Court Judge Michael Simons told the city of Portland that he wanted the city to report to him annually. The report is supposed to detail the progress made by the Portland Police Bureau on addressing problems detailed by a U.S. Department of Justice investigation. That investigation found that Portland police routinely engage in an excessive use of force, particularly toward people in mental health crises. Today, the city and the Department of Justice made a counter proposal to the judge's ruling. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Ashley Albies, one of the attorneys representing the Albina Ministerial Alliance and their lawsuit against the Portland Police Bureau, said the proposal is not a satisfactory solution.
Well, so the court had requested an annual status hearing where all the parties, including the AMA Coalition, the Department of Justice, the City of Portland, and the Portland Police Association, to come in for an annual hearing where the court would be advised by the parties as to the status of implementation of the proposed settlement agreement. And the court could then ask questions of the parties and the community outreach community liaison, the COCL. I believe that's the correct underlying, but it's the COCL would also be there to report to the court, and the court could ask the COCO questions on the status of implementation and become aware if there's any issues. The court would not have any authority to direct the parties to take any action as a result of this hearing. It would just be in its advisory capacity and its oversight capacity of the implementation if there were any issues and that sort of thing. And the court wanted the parties to all agree to engage in this process. And the proposal that was made by the city is a curtailment of the court's proposal. It's extremely limited, whereby the proposal made by the DOJ, the city, and the PPA would only allow the COCO to talk directly to the court and the court to ask questions of the COCO, and it would exclude participation of the Department of Justice by anybody else in the city, by the Portland Police Association, and would also exclude the AMA coalition from participating in this process.
Why is it that this proposal was made that, in fact, does limit the community's participation and input into the work that the police bureau is supposed to be doing toward solving some of these problems? Why did they make this kind of proposal?
I think that's a good question for the city and the PPA and the DOJ. It's a compromise proposal, clearly, because those were the three parties that submitted this proposal to the court. As you know, the AMA coalition did not join in that request because the AMA coalition thinks it's important to have the ability to talk to the court and the court to be able to talk to the AMA coalition, as well as all of the parties, to address any concerns or to answer any questions that the court might have, and to not have it just limited to the COCO itself. But the participation of the parties is extremely important for the court's ability to understand the status of implementation.
Dan Handelman of CopWatch says the city has made a reversal on its view of a coordination officer.
Their initial response was, well, that's not that person's job. They really shouldn't be being called into the court, and, you know, that's not an appropriate thing for them to do. But now they're saying that they want that person to be the person reporting to the judge. So I guess that's a good sign in the sense that maybe we're moving closer to what a court-appointed monitor would do. The bad thing is that they're saying nobody else can talk, and that cuts the community out. So if this court-appointed, or not court-appointed, if it's going to city-hired community compliance officer and community liaison turns out to be somebody who is not reflecting the concerns of the community, the judge is never going to hear what's really going on.
I can remember last year with the Citizens Review Board, there was an issue of accessibility of information and how much that organization had to do with affecting police policy or helping change police policy. Do you think there's some concern that the COCO might also not have the kind of direct access that the public might come to expect?
That's certainly a possibility, and should the court have a question or concern about that, the only person who could answer that question under the proposal submitted by the DOJ, the city, and the PPA would be the COCO. And so if the COCO doesn't have an answer or says, I don't know, that's the end of the inquiry, whereas the proposal offered by the court would then allow that the AMA coalition supports, would allow the court to then ask the city, well, what's going on here, or ask the DOJ, well, why isn't this being addressed?
But Dana Haynes, spokesperson for Mayor Charlie Hales, says, by contrast, that the COCO will exactly be the person to make sure the public has that kind of direct access to the Portland Police Bureau and the changes it needs to make to policy to improve its service to the community.
The community liaison person would be precisely what you just said. It would be that person to be the input for the community, the person who would take in all this testimony and these thoughts from all of the various communities that are involved. That would be when we have that person in place, that's precisely what that person's job would be, as envisioned by the Department of Justice, as envisioned by the City of Portland. When we get the right person for that job, it's going to be a very, very big job to take all that in and to make sure that the community does have this access and does get their input that they want. That'll be that liaison person's job. Not a job I envy. It'll be a tough job, but we're going to find the right person for it.
Well, just one other thing. When I talked to Ms. Albies, who is one of the co-attorneys for the Albina Ministerial Alliance, she had said that one of their concerns is that this person, in fact, might not be the kind of community liaison that the city is expecting them to be. I mean, do you foresee any reason why that person would not be as effective as a community liaison as you want them to be, as you envision them to be?
No.
I'm Don Merrill, Cable News.
A Portland judge ruled today that the federal no-fly list is unconstitutional. The decision came in an American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit brought on behalf of 13 Americans who found themselves on the list without any notice, reason, or way to get off of it. The judge ordered the government to create a new process that remedies these shortcomings, calling the current process wholly ineffective. She also said that the no-fly list violates the Fifth Amendment's guarantee of due process. The ruling also granted a key request in the lawsuit, ordering the government to tell the ACLU's clients why they are on the no-fly list and give them the opportunity to challenge their inclusion on the list before the judge. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with attorney Tom Nelson, who represents several local clients named in the lawsuit.
Some of the headlines saying that it declares the no-fly list unconstitutional. Is that a correct reading of today's ruling?
Yeah, actually, the order we're talking about comes from our very own Judge Anna Brown in Portland. And she has in front of her 13 plaintiffs. And the order is, as you say, that the no-fly list, as applied by the FBI and the Terrorism Screening Center, is unconstitutional. And the reason it's unconstitutional is that it does not give the people who are on the list either a notice when they're being put on it of the reasons why they're being put on it or an opportunity to contest the reasons why they're on the list. It's just it's a process that's completely secret and in the dark, and somebody wakes up in the morning and bingo, their name's on the list, and that's it. That's unconstitutional, said Judge Brown.
So what are the implications of today's ruling?
Well, I mean, first, it's an important and, in my opinion, a very proper step forward. Now, the next question is, well, what does the government have to do as a result of the order? And that's really going to be a very difficult question. The government can do a number of things. It will probably say that the reasons that people are on the no-fly list are secret and classified national security. And in those cases, the government's going to have to give some kind of indication to the people, well, why? What is the basis? Is there because somebody did on the Internet? Is it something that – some kind of indication why they're on the list so that the people at least have an opportunity to challenge the reasons why they're on the list without going to court. But it'll take a long time for that to develop. It'll be certainly months before there's any remedy available to the people who are on the no-fly list.
Have your clients ever been given a reason for the fact that they're on this no-fly list?
Why haven't they been given a reason?
Have they been given a reason?
No. It's impossible to find out why. You can guess and you can do all kinds of things, but it's really a Kafkaesque Catch-22. I can't think of enough descriptors to tell how absurd the process is. They do not give reasons. They don't say whether it's related to, I don't know, some kind of criminal record, owning guns, telephone calls to somebody, a desire to talk to somebody, a relative, somebody you talked to, somebody you met in a chat room. They don't tell you what the reason is. It's just super, super, super secret. And that means you have no opportunity to respond, as they often do when mistakes arise.
So what's the next step for your clients, just trying to work through the system to get their names off of this list?
Right. Well, we got a whole bunch of next steps, and each one is kind of individual. Mr. Tarhouni just today had his lawyers had a discussion with the government about how we get more information. We put in a request for documentation and information under what's called discovery, and got a very disappointing result. So today we talked with the government attorneys about probably filing a motion to compel. In the case of Mr. Fikre, which is, again, a separate case, we are now, in response to the judge's order, filing an amended complaint in Friday of this week that will broaden some of the claims we've made and give more clarity to some of them also.
Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Tom Nelson. He is a Portland attorney who represents several clients in the Portland area about a judge's ruling today that the no-fly list is unconstitutional. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Cover Oregon's interim CEO, Clyde Hamstreet, announced that the company will pay retention bonuses to its employees who stay on through March 15, 2015. The retention bonuses are aimed at keeping employees who have key IT skills and knowledge of healthcare regulations as enrollment moves to the federal exchange. Resignations and layoffs have left Cover Oregon staff at 163, down from 190 in April. Most staff will receive an extra 2 weeks if they remain on through March 15, 2015. 21 key staff members will get a bonus equal to 1 month's pay, and another 15 staff would receive 2 months' pay. While there's criticism of this latest move, Hamstreet defends the decision to pay bonuses, which would amount to around $650,000. Oregon is in the throes of an investigation about the failed healthcare exchange, blaming the contractor Oracle. Oracle claims that the website was functional, but Cover Oregon refused to release it. Yesterday, Cover Oregon announced that Aaron Patnode would become the new executive director as of July 14th.
The group Environment Oregon released a report today about the benefits of electric vehicles for breaking our dependence on oil, cleaning up our air, and improving our health and protecting our climate. More than 220,000 electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles are on America's roads today. In just the last 2 years, annual sales of electric vehicles, or EVs, have increased by 500%. KBOO was at the event this morning where Environment Oregon released the report. The event was held on Electric Avenue, a street near Portland State University, where only electric vehicles are allowed to park. The street is lined with charging stations for these vehicles.
My name is Patrick Connor, and I'm happy to speak to you on behalf of Plug in America. I am a lifelong Oregonian, and I started driving an electric car in 2007. That same year, we put 4 kilowatts of PV solar panels on our roof. Those solar panels allowed me to drive 16,000 miles a year on sunshine for free. I only drive about half that. So I'm driving for free and I have a lower utility bill. That's great. So what motivates you? What brought you here today? My guess is it's the hope of a better future with peace, clean air, clean water, and good green jobs. Well, EVs like these can help make all of those things possible. If you want to see renewable energy, electric vehicles are advancing the battery technology needed to make that happen. And after these cars are done with their mobile life, the batteries aren't just dead. They still work. They can have a second life, a semi-retired stationary life as grid backup for intermittent renewable sources. What about clean air? These are zero emission, and they can be fueled from renewable sources. What about locally sourced? As I mentioned, I fuel it from my rooftop. If you want clean water, well then you don't want oil pipelines or massive ships. We hear about the major spills, but there are spills happening every week. Just this week, there was a spill of 7,500 gallons into a Colorado River. EVs are better for our environment and our economy. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both. We can have green jobs and a greener future. EVs help our economy. Every fueling dollar we spend, the majority of that leaves our state. As mentioned earlier, that's $6 billion just for Oregon that we could be spending locally. I would much rather pay $1 a gallon to my local utility and fund them to install wind turbines than to send it overseas or to tar sands oils. My final thought, I'm a Desert Storm veteran, and war is devastating to everybody involved. Right now we're talking about going back to Iraq. No country's ever been invaded for their electricity grid. Thank you. Live regeneratively.
That was Patrick Connor, one of the speakers at an event this morning organized by Environment Oregon. The group's new report is called Driving Cleaner: More Electric Vehicles Means Less Pollution. The full text of the report can be found on their website, environmentoregon.org.
The city of Portland held the first of two public meetings this morning on whether and how the city will implement street fees for both residents of the city and businesses based in Portland. The town hall was moved to the convention center because the issue has captured a lot of local attention. For over 2 hours, residents and business owners gave testimony to a packed room. The testimony was overwhelmingly opposed to the street fees. Much of the debate on whether the city should impose a street fee revolves around a study by two Michigan researchers from 2012. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
That original study was part of a task assigned by the Minnesota legislature that looked at what they called value capture, or property-based ways of paying for infrastructure. Less than 36 cities around the country are using these kinds of fees to pay for road maintenance, and 28 of them are here in Oregon. Jason Jungi, who is the senior engineer at the Minnesota Department of Transportation and one of the co-authors of the study, said their use nationwide is not as popular as you might assume looking at their prevalence here in Oregon. The city of Portland will conduct 10 hearings overall on the proposal, and according to Mr. Jungi, understanding how the fees are assessed can be complicated.
So the main way that we looked at it was in terms of trip generation, which is Institute of Transportation Engineers publishes a manual that estimates how many trips a property is going to attract based on the land use. So a single family home would have one, apartments would have a different factor, and then businesses, it really varies from, you know, a store could have one, a fast food restaurant could have another, a gas station could have another. It's just on down the line by specific property type. And so properties could challenge those estimates if they were on the high end or the low end of their category. They would have a reasonable challenge. But it's still probably more fair than things like street frontage or acreage or something.
Right.
Or you could have a really large lot with a low intensity use that's really not creating all that much wear and tear on the streets.
Businesses weighed in today at the convention center on those street fees, and Dana Haynes, who is the spokesperson for Mayor Charlie Hales, heard the complaints of about 24 or so attendees.
Well, first off, I'm going to guess 30 people spoke, and of those 30, almost all of them wanted to say, this mechanism is good, this mechanism is terrible, I don't like the idea of a street fee, I don't like how it's approaching business, I don't like how it approaches residents. What we didn't hear from anybody, and which we haven't heard from anybody, is, you know what, our streets are fine, don't fix them. 40% of our streets are at poor to very poor condition, and I think most people recognize that we've got to start taking care of the biggest thing we own, our streets. But the mechanism by which we do it, and the mayor and Commissioner Novick have recommended a street fee, that's pretty unpopular, and we got lots of folks that came out today to say, don't like this idea.
I talked to Jason Jungi, who was one of the co-authors of the University of Minnesota study on the use of these kinds of fees to supplement communities. And one of the things in the study it said was, well, two things. One, property taxes are not a reliable source of income, and gas taxes are not a reliable source of income. But of the communities that have adopted street fees, a lot of them have rejected street fees. They started using them, and then they stopped using them. What is it that makes Portland think that once it starts using street fees, it'll be a reliable source of income?
Well, a couple of things. One is there are about 32 some odd street fees around the United States, and 28 of them are in Oregon. The reason for that? Sales tax. Most other communities pay for their streets with a sales tax. We don't have that luxury. So this is the mechanism that about 26, 27 different cities in Oregon do. Most of them had them for a long period of time. Some very, very conservative towns have them. Some very liberal towns have them. It's a mechanism by which lots of us take care of our streets, but the city of Portland is not. The reason we're recommending it is because for decades and decades, the federal government took care of streets by way of a federal gas tax. But they haven't adjusted the federal gas tax since 1993, and today it is not carrying the freight. So the city's got to do something about the streets, and so the street fee is what the mayor and the commissioner are recommending as the best option.
I asked Mr. Jungi what he thought the effect on low-income households would be, who are already stressed to pay for the basic necessities for owning a vehicle, and now they have to pay an extra street maintenance fee. What about low-income households who, don't even have enough money for gas sometimes, and now they have to pay a fee which is just about the same as someone who has the same amount of usage but has a higher income? I mean, did the study look at anything like that?
It's something we noted. I mean, there's a couple of ways to think of equity, I guess. There's one where it would be pay according to ability. And the other way would be pay according to benefit. And you could say that these are definitely on the the beneficiary pays rather than those who are more able to pay.
The city hopes to raise about $54 million a year from the fee, and they plan on trying to split that fee evenly between residents and business owners and other institutions. I'm Don Merrill, Cable News.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a report from KBOO's investigative reporting team on the effort by major agricultural corporations like Monsanto to influence food policy in Oregon. This will be followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes guest Carla Rossi, who will talk about the upcoming drag queen performance tour. Also, Jack Stocklin of Pervert the Cirque will share an invite to this weekend's circus performance on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rain, likely with a high of 67 degrees and an evening low of 59 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are: North Portland has 34 counts per minute, with spikes to 62. Vancouver, Washington has 30 counts per minute. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 32 CPM. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 35 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, on June 24, 2004, federal investigators questioned the former U.S. President George W. Bush for the connection with a news leak of the CIA operative and former U.S. Ambassador Valerie Plame. Bush later admitted that the leak was done by Scooter Libby, who Bush pardoned from federal prosecution. The quote of the day is from Colin Powell. Leadership is solving problems. The day soldiers stop bringing you their problems is the day you have stopped leading them. They have either lost confidence that you can help or concluded that you do not care. Either case is a failure of leadership.
It's 5:27, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Lloyd Blankfein is very concerned about income inequality. With his face reflecting both worry and perplexity, he recently called inequality, quote, very destabilizing. Lloyd's concern doesn't come from the perspective of one experiencing inequality from the bottom of the income ladder. He's certainly not an Occupy Wall Street sort of guy. In fact, he is Wall Street. A chief croupier of the financial gambling house Goldman Sachs, Blankfein raked in a stunning paycheck of $23 million for his wheeling and dealing last year. Overall, he's literally become a gold man, having sacked up a personal fortune of nearly $500 million during his years at Goldman, a tenure that included him grabbing a $13 billion bailout for the bank from us taxpayers in 2008. But in a June interview on CBS, Blankfein wrinkled his brow and uttered a very un-Wall Street, populist-like thought. Quote, too much of the wealth of the country has gone to too few people, he said, adding that when that happens, you'll have an unstable society. Well, golly, Pitchfork Lloyd, yes, we will. And don't look down now from your gilded perch way up there with the one percenters, but we already do. In the last 30 years, power elites, including you, drastically increase your share of America's income by taking income from the middle class and the poor. Did you think we wouldn't notice? This is Jim Hightower saying, it's awfully sweet of a Wall Street baron to express concern about inequality and instability, but how about doing something about it? You could turn your battalions of lobbyists and PR agents loose to develop a national jobs program, hike wages, bulk up Social Security, and, hey, here's a good one. Pass that little Robin Hood tax on computerized, high-speed Wall Street speculators to replenish our public treasury so we can reinvest in America.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Oh. AT&T has announced plans to merge with DirecTV, and the price tag for the endeavor comes to $70 billion. The merger of the two communications giants would further limit consumer choices regarding cable television services. It follows another high-profile merger last month between Comcast and Time Warner, which created the largest cable conglomerate in history. With that kind of money, AT&T could invest in high-speed internet instead of buying out the other company. For $70 billion, half the country could be connected. FreePress.net is a national nonpartisan organization that works on media reform focused on diverse and independently owned media ownership. Director Matt Wood gave testimony today in front of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee on antitrust competition policy and consumer rights. He argued that the committee should oppose the merger and should convince the Department of Justice and the FCC to do the same. Matt Wood spoke with me about the merger and its implications for our media landscape. This is Kristen Yount reporting for KBOO News. I'm speaking with Matt Wood. Matt Wood works for the Free Press. It is an organization that works on media reform through education, organizing, and advocacy. Matt spoke in front of the Senate this morning regarding AT&T's proposed merger with DirecTV. Matt, can you tell me what happened this morning in front of Congress?
Sure. AT&T and DirecTV were called in front of both the Senate and the House today to try and explain this deal. And, of course, they say it's going to help consumers. We don't take that claim very seriously because this deal could obviously help AT&T's bottom line. We just think it's going to lead to higher prices and fewer choices for customers, both for video and for broadband. And so we were there to provide the consumer side perspective on yet another huge merger. There have been a lot of them lately. Comcast trying to buy Time Warner Cable and Charter getting involved, and AT&T and DirecTV. There might be more coming down the road as well. So these are things that will certainly affect broadband and pay TV customers in Portland and really all across the entire country if all these big deals go through.
What did you have to say to the Senate?
Well, we told them that this deal would lead to a lot of concentration in the video market. AT&T isn't a huge TV provider, but they do have about 5.5 million customers nationwide, and combining that with DirecTV would take away an option that people have for cable or for pay TV services. We also said that AT&T has made promises before about broadband, and they're doing that again here. Every time they have a merger, they want to get past regulators. They say, hey, let us do the merger, and we promise to build better broadband. Well, they've said that every time they've had a merger, and they haven't always kept those promises. And we think that rather than making promises, they should be making investments, that they could take the money they're investing in DirecTV and in this merger, which is almost $70 billion by the end of the day, and they could actually use that to build future-proof fiber-based broadband rather than just providing minimum upgrades or sometimes not providing them and not keeping those promises.
So this is just simply a way to make money. It has nothing to do with increasing the quality of people's broadband experience. It's just a way to rake it in, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that was their basic selling point was, well, we can give people bundled services. But, of course, AT&T, when they want to sell you broadband and video, it's not to save you money. It's so they bring more of your money to them. This might be a good idea for these big companies. It might save them some money when it comes to what they spend on getting video programming and some other ways. You know, Wall Street talks about synergies all the time, and for most of us that means job cuts, not anything that we're really looking forward to. So there might be some efficiencies in the deal, but we just have no reason to think those will be passed along to customers in the form of lower prices.
Thank you so much for speaking with us tonight. Can you give our listeners some information about where they can find out more about the merger and more about the Free Press organization?
Sure. Yeah, we're at freepress.net. We have about 750,000 members on our email list nationwide and worldwide, really, and we have information at freepress.net about the merger and about ways you can take action and tell your lawmakers about this merger and the Comcast merger and other open internet and media consolidation issues. So always happy to talk to people directly, but that website is a great place to start for information.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is Kristen Yount reporting for KBOO News.
A Methodist pastor who was removed from his position for officiating at his son's same-sex wedding will be reinstated by a Pennsylvania bishop. The United Methodist Church officially opposes marriage equality, but may reconsider that position after the largest Protestant church in the U.S., the Presbyterian Church, approved marriage equality last week at their national convention. Reverend Frank Schaefer lost his position as a pastor last September after performing a marriage ceremony for his gay son. He spoke to Pacifica Radio at that time about why he decided to officiate at his son's wedding, even knowing that he would lose his position by doing so.
I have my convictions, and I acted upon my conscience. I followed my heart, and this is what I believe and what I stand for. Was it worth it? Absolutely. For the love of my son, I would never do anything else. It's kind of ironic that this was over an act of love. You know, when I agreed to officiate at my son's wedding, it was really an act of love, and this act of love forced me to choose between the love of my son and the love of my career, my church, and of course I chose my son, even though that was in some sense a difficult decision, and I was at the time aware of the fact that I might lose my career over this. I have to tell you this, I was so nervous and so scared before I took that witness stand. When I started, all of a sudden, I felt the prayers of the people. I felt a strength that I didn't expect to have at that moment when I looked at them and said, look, if I'm going to be a United Methodist pastor tomorrow, I want you to know that I will not refuse ministry to anybody. And I told them that I would no longer be a silent supporter of my children, but that I would be an advocate.
That was Reverend Frank Schaefer, who has now been officially reinstated as a Methodist pastor after having been removed for officiating his son's same-sex wedding. The Methodist Church lawyer is still deciding on whether to appeal the decision to return Schaefer to his post to the Methodist Church's highest court.
In Iraq today, 15 civilians were met with a spray of bullets fired by al-Qaeda fighters, killing two young girls and injuring a number of other civilians. The attack targeted a Shia Turkmen community in Iraq. Over the past week, violence in Iraq has intensified as the group known by the acronym ISIS has carried out attacks across the country. ISIS stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and the group pushes for a political interpretation of Islam, condemned even by al-Qaeda as too violent and strict. Alleged members of ISIS now control a large swath of territory in northern and western Iraq, including the second biggest city, Mosul. Iraqi officials announced today that the Iraqi military has managed to maintain control of a key oil refinery while fighting against ISIS. President Obama announced Friday that 300 troops would be sent to Iraq to support the efforts of the Iraqi military. The soldiers will be working alongside soldiers from Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which were also sent to Iraq last week to oppose the Sunni-led insurgency.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, June 24th, 2014. Two Palestinians were injured on Tuesday when Israeli soldiers invaded the southern West Bank district of Bethlehem. Troops searched and ransacked homes in different parts of the city and nearby villages before kidnapping three men as well. Furthermore, soldiers invaded Araba town south of the northern West Bank city of Jenin, kidnapped one Palestinian and stole large sums of cash. According to local sources, dozens of soldiers invaded the town and broke into the home of Mustafa Shabani before kidnapping his brother Najib. The soldiers violently searched the property, causing excessive property damage, and stole 5,000 shekels. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded various Palestinian communities in the northern West Bank district of Nablus, detained dozens of Palestinians, and kidnapped two. Elsewhere in the West Bank, two Palestinians were wounded after a number of settlers chased their car and threw a gas bomb at it near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Local sources said that the attack took place near Deir Ebzir village west of Ramallah. The settlers came from a nearby illegal Israeli settlement. The sources said that the settlers' car chased a Palestinian car on a joint road used by Israeli settlers and also leads to a number of Palestinian villages and towns west of Ramallah before a settler threw a gas bomb at the car. Medical sources said that the bomb appears to contain ingredients that targets the nervous system, causing symptoms similar to paralysis. Barely able to move and speak, the two wounded Palestinians told Israeli soldiers at a nearby roadblock that the settlers have attacked them and even identified the vehicle as it was parked near the roadblock. The soldiers did not listen to the complaint of Palestinians and pushed them away after threatening to kidnap them. In other news, Israeli settlers invaded on Tuesday Barta'a Palestinian village south of the northern West Bank city of Jenin and handed military orders for the destruction of more than 10 stores. Local sources announced that dozens of soldiers and members of the civil administration office run by the military in the occupied territories invaded the industrial area in the village and handed the orders. Soldiers also conducted searches of various homes and property in the village, causing damage. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, June 24th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, at least 35 civilians have been killed and over 40 others injured during clashes in the southern Helmand province of Afghanistan. The gun battle between Taliban fighters and Afghan security forces broke out in Sangin district 5 days ago, and reports suggest that clashes are still continuing between the two sides. Heavy explosions were heard in capital Kabul late Tuesday night. Preliminary reports suggest a number of rockets landed near the Kabul airport, injuring several people. Supporters of Afghan President candidate Abdullah Abdullah have held street protests in Kabul, challenging alleged fraud in the election 1 week ago. Abdullah has boycotted the vote count, pitching Afghanistan into a political crisis. In an effort to ease the crisis, Afghanistan's chief electoral officer resigned on Monday. The official's resignation was one of the demands of candidate Abdullah Abdullah. The current political crisis has threatened to undermine the country's first democratic transfer of authority.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Merrill, Kristen Yount, and Amy Johnson. The producer and engineer is Sikornia Wright. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter as at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Neil Thompson.
And I'm Kristen Yount. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy... Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's 7. Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio with author and political analyst Norman Pollack. His new book, Eichmann on the Potomac, deals with the issue of drone warfare. At 9, on Political Perspectives, it's Economic Update. Host Richard Wolff discusses a new book, Unbalanced, The Codependency of America and China, by Stephen Roach. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Recovery Zone, author Stephen Harrod Bunner discusses plant intelligence in the imaginal realm. Thanks for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for a report from KBOO's investigative reporting team on the efforts by major agricultural corporations to stop Oregon counties from labeling and limiting genetically modified foods.
Good night, Neil.
Good night, Kristen.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. Jackson County, Oregon is a quiet place. On any given day, the traffic from I-5 and the sound of tractors in the distance might be all you hear for hours. The county's known for farming, with fields and orchards covering thousands of acres in the Rogue River and Applegate Valleys.
Jackson County recently became ground zero for an effort to ban the production of genetically modified foods. Opposing these efforts were some of the biggest corporations in the world, and politicians aligned with the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, are generally defined as agricultural products which contain the genes of another organism, typically bacteria, that make it resistant to commercial pesticides or pest insects. GMOs have become a contentious issue, as some claim they cause adverse health effects, and that their propagation has negative impacts not only on farmland ecology, but on the surrounding community as well. A handful of localities in the U.S., in many countries worldwide, have banned them, but the transgenic agriculture industry and the chemical producers it partners with form an enormously powerful lobby that has fought tooth and nail against bans or labeling of products which contain GMOs.
In Jackson County, this became a reality in late February 2012 when farmer Chris Hardy discovered the presence of GMO sugar beets growing adjacent to land he was leasing.
Genetically engineered sugar beets were being grown just down the road across the street virtually from where we farm. It was right virtually on the city limits of Ashland, right out the back of the Ashland Middle School and a couple elementary schools. And I knew others in the community in the right down the street, you know, literally blocks away, that were saving seeds on beets and chard. So I knew that this would likely be putting transgenic pollen into, you know, not only local farmers' seed stock, but our own farms' seed.
Hardy soon found that Syngenta, a Swiss agribusiness and agrochemical company, had been growing GMO beets in the area unbeknownst to non-GMO farmers for almost a decade. GMO beets can pollinate non-GMO beets, as well as Swiss chard. And non-GMO foods are highly regulated. Their supposed purity is their selling point. So the revelation had impacts for those growing non-GMO vegetables. Eli Dimitru, a Jackson County resident who campaigned for the GMO ban, said that genetic contamination from GMO pollen could also lead to non-GMO farmers being sued.
All the genetically engineered crops are, if a farmer or landowner is going to plant them on their land, they have to sign a contract with the owner of the patent, whether it's Monsanto or Syngenta or DuPont, in order to get the seeds to plant them. The corporation that they signed that contract with owns that crop. They own the rights to the crop. You can't take the seeds from that crop and replant them. It's a huge contract that very tightly regulates the farmer and what they can do. And so, because they have patent rights over the seed, so if that genetic material from the seed that they own patents for crosses into another farmer's field, the court has said that company still owns the patent rights to that genetic material, even though it's invaded another farmer's crop. Those companies have actually sued small farmers for growing their patented crops when their patented crops invaded the small farmers.
Syngenta's sugar beets were regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and required a buffer with a 4-mile radius be between their crops and non-GMO farms. Initially, the farmers and Syngenta tried to form a seed association to map where GMO and non-GMO farms could coexist. But the Rogue Valley, where Ashland sits, is only 8 miles across, making negotiations difficult. Syngenta, not wanting to divulge where it was growing, walked out in early June 2013. Days later, anonymous persons dug up a beet field full of Syngenta GMO beets in the middle of the night, an act which the FBI called economic sabotage. 6,500 GMO beet plants, which were about to flower, were destroyed.
The Jackson farmers decided to respond by putting an initiative on the ballot banning the growth of GMO crops. The measure, 15-119, now puts a coalition of farmers against state agricultural interests, sugar companies, and international agribusiness. Then the Big Six came in. The Big Six are six major agribusiness and agrochemical firms: Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, BASF, Bayer, and Syngenta. They are multi-billion dollar corporations who each have spent tens of millions of dollars in political contributions and lobbying. Together, they poured money into successful campaigns to defeat GMO labeling in California and Washington state. Monsanto would contribute $180,000 to the effort to stop Jackson 15-119. DuPont spent $125,000. Spending by GMO-free Jackson County would have easily broken records for political spending on a ballot initiative in the county. They raised over $400,000. In all, the opposition to the GMO ban raised almost $1 million, with the Big Six raising more than GMO-free Jackson entirely, $450,000. A glut of expensive political ads overtook the airwaves.
There's a lot of political bull starting to fly around Jackson County. Out-of-state chemical corporations aren't happy that the family farms measure would protect our family farms.
Genetically engineered crops are threatening Jackson County's family farmers. One gust of wind and pollen patented by giant chemical corporations can trespass onto farms like mine.
If Measure 15-119 passes, it would be very unfair to us as farmers who are trying to make a good, honest living.
Ballot measure 15-119 will be very bad for a lot of families.
Jared Waters is a Jackson County farmer who has grown conventionally as well as leased plots to grow GMOs. He supported the ban and said that the history of the Big Six inspired others to approve it too.
For a lot of the people, the reason they got involved was just the
history of the companies that are pushing GMOs is not a good history. I mean, Vietnam with Agent Orange, DDT, we've got lots of farmers down here dying from DDT.
Waters said that his break with GMO farming was for economic reasons, and that his opposition to GMO crops is due to irresponsible growing practices by GMO farmers, which can place neighboring farmers' crops at risk.
You know, I'm not an environmentalist by any means. I agree with the environmental accountability, where if I destroy something, that I should be accountable for it, whether it was intentional or accidental. The term organic is, I think, something that should not be applied at all when it's GMO, non-GMO, because GMO can contaminate organic or conventional, but nothing can contaminate GMO.
GMOs also had a large impact on the state economy early in 2013. An anonymous farmer in northeastern Oregon had found an illegal patch of Roundup herbicide-resistant wheat patented by Monsanto growing in the middle of his conventional wheat field. GMO wheat had been grown for test trials in the region in 1994 and again in 2005, but was never approved or mass-produced, so no one knew how Roundup-ready wheat came to be growing in the middle of a field of conventional wheat years later. In response, Asian markets with GMO bans canceled purchases worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and Oregon's ability to export wheat internationally was in doubt.
Scott Dahlman is the executive director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter, a pro-GMO and pesticide lobbying group with representatives from Monsanto and Syngenta on its board, along with state and national farming organizations. Oregonians for Food and Shelter campaigned against the ban. Dahlman contends the ban will hurt local farmers.
Our members, actual farmers down there, either use the technology or want to use the technology, and felt that that was at risk, which obviously it was, and now many of them are in a very bad situation.
On May 20th, Jackson County voters went to the polls and resoundingly banned GMOs with 66% approval, becoming just one of a handful of jurisdictions in the entire United States where GMO crops are banned. Josephine County, Jackson's neighbor to the west, also passed a ban on May 20th, but now they're most likely unable to enforce it.
Both Jackson and Josephine counties passed their GMO bans via voter-created and approved referendums, but Jackson County's GMO ban made the ballot before an Oregon law came into effect, which would preempt it. 2013 Senate Bill 863 preempts localities from regulating agricultural seeds or any produce that would grow from it. When it was initially introduced as Senate Bill 633, its critics called it the Monsanto Protection Act and said it was a specific response to the two anti-GMO initiatives. Dahlman doesn't disagree.
It was a response to what we saw going on in a lot of areas. It hadn't really been considered before that local entities would start trying to regulate what kind of agricultural seed a farmer could plant. And so I think that Jackson County brought some attention to that, but it was a much broader issue for our members. As a statewide organization representing members all over the state, the potential for a patchwork of regulations was very, very concerning.
SB 863 was passed in a special session, primarily concerned with limiting public employee pension costs and funding education, where lawmakers were informed by Governor John Kitzhaber that he would sign all the bills he could compromise on or none. The result was last year's so-called grand bargain. ALEC is an organization that brings conservative state legislators and some of the most powerful corporations in the world together for closed-door sessions where they work together to create industry-friendly model legislation. These bills, once approved by ALEC, are then taken back to state houses by member legislators and introduced. In this case, SB 633 was written by a representative from Oregonians for Food and Shelter and adopted by ALEC word for word. In Salem, SB 633 was sponsored by ALEC member Senator Bill Hansel. The bill initially had bipartisan support, notably with Senator Betsy Johnson, but she would later vote against it after her constituents complained. Oregon Representative Sal Esquivel, another ALEC member, was the co-chair of the Agriculture Subcommittee of ALEC's Energy, Environment, and Agriculture Task Force when ALEC's preemption model bill was first approved. Jeff Case, Esquivel's co-chair and a director for Crop Life America, an agribusiness trade group, told a reporter that he couldn't remember who had submitted the ALEC preemption bill, but that it was, quote, probably a representative from Oregon. Dahlman said that his organization had no input in promoting the bill at ALEC's national summit.
I have read in some stories that it became part of a conversation there, but I am not familiar with any of the details surrounding that. We were not involved in that at all, so I can't say either way. I've read about it in the media, just like everybody else, but had no part in that.
Jackson County's GMO initiative won an exemption from Senate Bill 863 with the intervention of State Representative Peter Buckley, a Democrat who represents Jackson County. But the law was declared an emergency, meaning it went into effect on the day it was signed, October 3, 2013. The Josephine County GMO ban, which made it onto the ballot later that year, sits on shaky ground. Jared Waters doesn't think much of ALEC.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit here and there, and what I have heard is not good. They have the interest of corporations at heart, not the interest of the residents of and citizens of the United States and the residents of Oregon. But, you know, what the one thing that I have heard about ALEC, though, is that they don't have the small business person's best interests, that they were formed by these large corporations and that their interests are what they care about.
Dahlman said that Oregonians for Food and Shelter are considering challenging the Jackson County GMO ban, though they haven't made a decision. He also said that he expects the court to strike down Josephine County's ban.
I think the courts are going to be working it out one way or another. We think that it is clearly preempted by that law.
Chris Hardy, the farmer who found the GMO beets in the first place, says that Jackson County's response at the polls should suffice.
It's, you know, the two-thirds of Jackson County citizens voting in favor of our ballot of the measure 15119 should send a clear message to any politicians, legal battle that they're barking up the wrong tree. Our citizens in Jackson County and in Josephine County believe that protecting the future, believe in protecting family farms in southern Oregon is more important than protecting the interests of chemical corporations.
This KBOO Special Investigative Report was produced collaboratively by Mike Klepfer, Don Merrill, Sam Smith, Yana Maximova, and Sam Bowman.